Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you today?
A bit busy and frazzled, but I am here and excited about what we're going to talk about tonight.
Oh, very good. So, and if our listeners and viewers are also interested, just like I am, because I don't know what it is, please consider clicking the subscribe button, which is down below. Click the bell to be notified when we release new content. The Linktree link is down below in the description, and that will take you to all things paranormalist related, our Facebook groups, email address, Patty's blog. And one new line in there, I added the buy me a coffee.
Oh.
So, because I am a coffee aficionado.
He is indeed.
Now, please don't feel any pressure to do that. You know, so if you like the content and you would like to buy us a coffee, please do.
All right.
And if not, we'll still be doing this. No problem.
Yes, we're doing it because it's a labor of love. Mm-hmm. So you ready?
Yes, please.
All right. So I'm going to preface this by saying that I have had a great deal of pressure placed upon me by a certain young gentleman who is fascinated with the paranormal and who happens to also be my middle son. And he was telling me, I want you to do something on the Native American spirits and what have you. And I have to confess that like most modern people, we assume that the lore and legends of the indigenous people and a lot of our own legends from Europe and what have you are just that. Stories people made up to explain things that happened that they didn't have an explanation for. So they chose what worked in their time frame and their area. So fairies and, you know, ogres and what have you, banshees. And in the Native American community, in the Algonquin-speaking community, the Wendigo. So I'm going to refer to the Algonquin-speaking community because it is not a nationality, it is a language. Much like some people speak French or Italian, there is an entire group of several nations of people who speak or spoke Algonquin. And that was kind of a thing that kind of brought them all together, having that commonality of language, but they had their own distinct rituals, traditions, things of that nature as well. So, I might make some differentiations between like the Cree or a different nation of people who spoke Algonquin. But the Wendigo seems to travel through the lore of all the Algonquin speaking people. And this, to give you a reference for a map, would be from the lower part of Canada all the way through the northeast of the United States and all the way out to Wisconsin and the Northwest as well. So it's a northern entity. When I started, I thought these are going to be great stories from just a long time ago, and they're just going to be legends. Most commonly today, we see the Wendigo and it's portrayed as a deer head, a deer skeleton, a skeletal head with antlers on a human body. And that is not only a simplistic version of it, but probably not even a really accurate version of what it looks like. And we're going to get into the fact that it's a process. And as I was going through the reading for this, and I have to tell you, I've read 3.5 books in the last couple weeks working on this. I have never done more research in my life for a single podcast. So I hope this one offers you a lot of information and makes you aware of something that very well could still be stalking the woods of the Northeast and the Northwest today.
Once again, you're going to make it really difficult for me to go into any kind of woodland anymore.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
But I have to tell you, okay, so I'm going to, as we're going through this, I'm going to tell you that I found parallels to something we're all familiar with and which most people today believe. And I think this is their way to explain it in some respects. And I'm being a little cryptic right now, I apologize, but it'll all make sense in the next 30, 40 minutes, I promise. So stick in there with me. So to give you an idea, so the Wendigo is part demon, part vampire, part witch. It is a monster with a heart literally frozen into ice. It is a starving creature. It haunts the cold and the darkness. It sounds insane and incredible, but it has aspects of all of these things. The Wendigos seek out and are most active in the winter months. Now, from a sociological view, you could say, well, yes, that was the lean time for the people. And they lived, they had to prepare the whole 6 months that they were in warm weather for survival during this time. And it wasn't like today, even though I know it's really, really cold in Wisconsin and Michigan and places like that. And certainly in large parts of Canada, even in the in our region, it can get pretty cold, like 20 below zero sometimes. But think about having to live through that without a grocery store, without electricity, with having to gather your wood, huddle in a hogan, a teepee, a tent, whatever it was. And how do you find food? How do you hunt? Do you see many deer in the lean times? Like, you know, after like December, January, the deer are very hard to find. You don't even see them running across the road most of the time. They're battened down as best they can be for the cold as well. So it becomes a time of starvation and freezing and death. And not only that, but now you isolate. So in a lot of the Algonquin communities, you would think that they would band together to take care of each other during that cold, but they didn't. And the reason they didn't is because if you were all together, then you had one small area to hunt. Less chance for everybody to have food. One small area to gather wood. Eventually you'll use up that resource and you won't have enough wood to survive the winter. So they would spread out into family pods and put some distance between themselves and the next pod of people, whether it was a long house or whatever it was they were living in, so that they had a better chance of survival. Because if you killed the deer in that area, you killed the deer for everyone and nobody got to eat after a little while. So think about how cold and isolating and terrible it is. I'm going to tell you a story to kind of set the stage for what's to come. The first known written mention of a Wendigo goes all the way back to 1636. The stories and the creature itself goes far back into the myths of Native American history. But this is the first time a European wrote it down. The gentleman's name was Paul Lejeune. He was a French Jesuit missionary who was ministering to the Algonquin people in Quebec. And he described a woman who warned that the Atachin had eaten some of the tribal members nearby. Now that's another word for a Wendigo. You will find multiple names for them throughout the literature, but they all come back to that basic description. Now this woman is telling the priest that this terrible thing has happened, that some of the people from his church are gone because they were eaten, and that if he didn't do something, many more would be eaten. And he was, you know, he wrote about this, about the fact that the people were missing, they weren't found. And this woman was adamant about what was happening. There are some other stories to kind of keep in the back of your mind as we talk about this. And we'll get into them in just a little bit of time. Now, for those of you who think this sounds like it's interesting, but what so much? We're going to break down the Wendigo to something specific. She's called the Skadeamooch. The Skadeamooch. And it is a ghost witch. This is the first version of the Wendigo you're going to find. So Wendigos are actually, according to the lore of the native peoples, witches who are of great power and who work blood magic or black magic during their lifetime. They are not interested in helping people. They're interested in power. They were sorcerers with great power. And they have a Wendigo, a demonic entity that is attached to them that remains with them. And after death, that entity animates them and allows them to live in an undead state. They are alive and yet they're animated but dead. They are sort of shapeshifters sometimes, prowling. They consume and they're hungry. They have a hunger that cannot be filled, a cold that cannot be warmed. They are starving, avid, like a vampire. And
or a zombie.
Yeah. Or a zombie, yeah. They are avidly hungry all the time. And they are constantly devouring prey. It doesn't feed them. It only satiates them for a few moments, and then the starvation returns, that desire to fill that need. And they come out only in the most cold. They're very rarely reported in warm times, only in the cold times. And they are literally frozen. I can't say it any better than that. They are frozen. They literally, their heart, you've heard about a cold-blooded killer. This is the essence of a cold-blooded killer. Literally, its heart will freeze, its insides will freeze, its blood will freeze. It is literally a frozen being that is animated and moving. One of the things I found really interesting was there are three phases of a Wendigo. There is the sorcerer phase, there's an intermediate phase, and then there was the monstrosity phase. So a person can, and often does, start out looking for a totem, a guiding animal or a guiding spirit. In most Native American cultures, there's a moment when young men go out and seek their guiding spirit, the totem that will be with them their life. It helps to tell them what job they're going to take in the community. So maybe if they dream of an owl or they dream of a porcupine, maybe they're going to be a healer. If they dream of a bear or a wolf, you can hear my cat in the background. Mm-hmm. I apologize. He's my 21-year-old. He's yodeling, looking for a buddy. If they look, you know, they talk about a bear or something like that that they see in a dream, they might be a great hunter, a great warrior, something like that. Those beings are considered good, and they're positive, and they're a part of the cycle of growing up for most young men in the Native American cultures for the Algonquins, and in other cultures as well, but we're specifically going to stick with the Algonquins. And they're considered sacred. They often come in dreams, or they come during the trances that come with starvation. So when a boy reaches 12 years old or something along that, they would go out into the wild. They would go without any food, and they would have to go hungry for several days. And a dream would come to them, or a vision would come to them. And this would tell them basically who they were going to be as an adult man. And this, once they have this, they cross the threshold from boyhood to manhood. And so that was important. But so does the being, the demonic entity that becomes the Wendigo. It comes to you in dreams quite often. Now, one of the things I found interesting was that the dream pattern is really the same or similar to other cultures. You will dream that this being, whatever it looks like, it could be a beautiful woman, it could be an animal, will offer you a plate of what appears to be buffalo or venison cooked. And if, obviously, if you're starving, you've been not eating for 3 or 4 days, you're hungry. And in your dream, you just can salivate and you're thinking, I will take that bite. But if in the dream you allow yourself to take a bite of that, you've allowed the Wendigo to enter you, because it's not what it appears to be. It is cooked human meat.
Ooh.
And that's the key. The Wendigo is a demonic entity that devours humans. And if you taste human flesh, even in a dream, you have now opened a door for this thing to come into you.
Along that lines, what happens to the souls of the victims?
I would think the victims would go to whatever version of heaven, you know, of the afterlife that their particular culture has, because they are victims. Mm-hmm. The spirit that is going to be struggling is going to be the one who allows or has accepted the Wendigo spirit into it. So the best way to explain this to you is it's kind of like a frog. First it's the eggs. That's the spirit. That's the part where you're dreaming. And then you become a tadpole. That'll be the second stage. And the third stage is when you become a frog, or in this instance, when you become a literal monster. And we'll get to them in just a minute. The spirit that is going to be the Wendigo pretends that it is a Powagon, which is the totem spirit. And so then you let it in, or maybe you seek it out because you have visions of power that you want to pursue, whatever your way of getting to it. Once it comes into your life, then we're going to talk about the possession. It begins to possess you. It is very analogous to demonic entities. So first you have, it attacks you. Then it oppresses you, and then it possesses you. And that's exactly the same trinity of events that happens with a Wendigo. That's what really fascinated me, is like you could very easily see how we got from point A to point B. And once this thing starts to go down that path, suddenly the person who's possessed by the Wendigo, they stop eating, they show great strength, they speak in languages that the people don't know. They speak to demons. There are stories of them speaking with multiple tongues at the same time. There are stories of shaman who have attempted to stop the Wendigo possession, and that their tents, in their teepees, there would be voices, multiple voices screaming and speaking in multiple languages at the same time as they attempted to exorcise whatever this entity is. And interestingly enough, as the Judeo-Christian worked its way through, a lot of the natives, if they couldn't seek out one of their own priests or holy men, would go to Christian holy men and ask for help. So it's really fascinating, the correlations that I had never anticipated that are there. So that said, I would like to start telling some of the stories. The first story I wanted to tell you, there was a gentleman by the name of Swift Runner. This story is probably one of the most well-known stories of a Wendigo in the entire world. This takes place in Alberta, Canada, in the winter of 1878 to 1879. Swift Runner was a Cree man from the Cree people, and he was very well known in the town he lived in. Everybody knew him, his wife, their kids, the whole nine yards. And they moved to their winter camp, you know, to fish and hunt and take care of things rather than living in town. When he returns to town months later, he tells this bizarre story that his family died of starvation, that everybody, you know, they fought to the last end, but he couldn't find any food. And he was so devastated, but he looked like he had put on weight. So obviously the mounted police in the area were suspicious of this man reporting the missing family, that they all died from starvation. Well, he's looking pretty hale and hearty. So they said, you know, let's just take a little trip out there, Swift Runner and take a look and see what we can find. Maybe we can help you bring the bodies back. And he was like, oh, no, that I buried them out there. But they decided to go look anyway. And what they found were that the camp was strewn with human bones. Some of them showed obvious gnaw marks. The entire family had been murdered and eaten. And he had definitely committed cannibalism. When he finally confessed to having killed and eaten his family, he said that it began with the strange dreams, that a spirit came to him and told him to eat his family, which is his wife, his brother, his mother, and his six children.
Wow.
He said, seriously, over months, he said he couldn't help himself, that the spirit possessed him and made him to do it. It was a harsh winter, but it was not that harsh. And here's something that's really fascinating about this. People who are oppressed or possessed by a Wendigo no longer desire our normal foods. They make them sick. They won't eat. If you gave them porridge or, you know, corn pone or something like that, they wouldn't touch it. They have a specific desire only for human flesh.
Similar to vampires not being able to eat regular food either.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's like I said, you're going to see so many correlations that, like, you sit there and you go, oh my gosh, how could that be? But it's very similar. Now, he even admits that he killed his last son and ate him, not because of his starvation, because obviously he wasn't starved and there was a little bit of food left there that nobody got to eat because he killed them. He killed his youngest son and ate him so there would be no witnesses left to his crimes. He was hung in December of 1879 in Fort Saskatchewan, and he never recanted that this was a Wendigo possession, and that after it happened, the Wendigo left him, and he had to deal with the consequences of his actions. Now, there is something that is called Wendigo psychosis, and it's a culture-bound syndrome. Some scientists and psychologists think it's true, it's real. Others think it's just a nice way to explain away something as a mental health issue when there's nothing else you can use to, you know, get past it. So rather than say it's a Wendigo, we'll say you've got a mental illness. So I thought that was interesting. There, this doesn't just happen just in Canada, although a lot of them are Canadian stories. There is a place in Salton, Wisconsin, where there is a lake that is called the Wendigo Lake, or Lake Wendigo. It is about a 200-acre lake in the middle of an island called Cass Lake, with another lake around the edge of it. So there's a ton of lakes up there, okay? So there's a spit of land and then Cass Lake on the other side. And so it's really a lake within a lake, if you can envision that.
So a moat of land.
Basically, yeah, yep. A moat of land.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the beginning of time of our recording the stories, there have been stories about something that comes from that lake. In the late 20th century, a researcher by the name of Carol Ryan gathered stories about Lake Wendigo. What she found is that the native people talked about the fact that there were these exit holes in the lake once it was frozen, that something or some things that were very large chipped their way up from under the frozen lake and got out, and that giant footprints could be seen on the lake surface and on the snow and the snowbanks as it walked out of the lake and into the woods. And when I say giant, I mean really large footprints. Said the rare footprints and exit holes from something large or things that are large on the lake are found when the lake freezes over. She said the traditional story was that the lake was used as a big kettle by a group of cannibal giants, or Wendigo, for boiling humans, and that a Native American chief had ventured to the island to stop this and had never returned. There is a lot of lore about what occurred there. And I just thought it was completely fascinating. So we're going to talk a little bit about another case in Winnipeg. And there was a case of a cannibal that was reported in an area called the Peace River Country. And these people were not hungry. This was not in the coldest part of the winter, but the people started to disappear and were found literally devoured. It turned out that the story was passed around that it was the work of a woman who became a Wendigo years earlier, that she had killed and eaten 12 people, including her own family. She was alive at last counts in Edmonton. This would have, this case actually came from the March 16, 1888 Fort Wayne Sentinel article called Cannibal. 12 people are said to have been killed and eaten by this woman, is the lead to the article. She was never caught nor arrested, although people knew who she was, and she was well known locally, and she was never punished for her crime because they couldn't catch her. She went into the wilderness and that was the end of that. Another symptom of this possession is the swelling of the body. So the victims, they call it grow large. So they swell up. And not only do they swell up, but they also grow eventually. We'll get to the third stage where they begin to grow in a minute. So this is from a diary of a Hudson Bay clerk named Francis Beaton in 1897. Beaton was stationed at Trout Lake, where this incident happened, where a Cree man by the name of Spinanum underwent horrific Wendigo metamorphosis. Beaton's diary describes it like this. He says his heart is freezing. He is always saying, I am going to be a cannibal. He wants them to kill him before the time when he gets worse. So he's literally begging the people there with him to kill him because he knows what's happening to his body. He seems to be getting worse all the time. He does not look like a human being anymore. He seems to be terribly swollen in the body and face. I do not know how this will end. The sight of him is enough to frighten any person. The sound of him is terrible. He was calling like a wild bull. They tried to keep him tied down for his protection and for theirs over the course of several weeks, but he could break all the bonds. Once they were out of rope and any means to restrain him, the locals felt they had no other choice than to kill him. His execution was justified by the fear that if he got loose, he would kill them all. I thought that was quite compelling. Almost all the people who are in the early stages of this Wendigo possession will describe it the same. Their heart is slowly freezing or turning to ice. They don't mean just so they aren't feeling. They're talking about literally turning to ice, literally freezing in their body. They literally, their victims, their chests will literally pop. This is fascinating to me. They're describing that they will become cold, literally cold-hearted. They will freeze. Their chests will start to pop like ice under pressure, the sound of ice crunching and scraping in their joints.
Wow.
In some cases, they state their backbone bone is turning to ice. Stranger still is how witnesses or Wendigo hunters have backed up these statements after the death of the victim. There are numerous accounts that state that the Wendigo was killed and their heart or spine was removed or opened and found to be encased in ice. Hearts are traditionally removed and burned to melt the ice along with the rest of the body to ensure it does not rise back up from the dead. And the authors of this, and I will give their name in their book and stuff later, they said that they actually looked to see if there might be a double meaning for the word ice in the Algonquin language. To the best of their ability, they can find no other meaning for the word ice, not just emotionally cold, anything like that. They literally mean frozen.
And you think people from Canada or the northern tier of the U.S. would know what ice is.
Exactly. then as they go further into it and they begin to consume human flesh, like this freezing stuff happens before they start to consume. As long as they haven't consumed human flesh, there is the opportunity, the possibility that a good shaman or priest could help them get rid of it. Once they've consumed human flesh, they're done. That's it. If you're in that first stage and you're starting to freeze, one of the remedies was that they would be forced to drink hot tallow or bear grease because it would warm you and melt you and also help with the starvation, because you're not eating any food. You have no desire to, but the calories from that fat will help you to stay alive. It is believed that the food from the hot food will actually help them, but it doesn't always work. And a lot of times it's just simply not enough. Sometimes these things creep upon them, like I said, in their sleep. Sometimes they attach to them. Sometimes you can become possessed by a Wendigo by violating the codes and morals and ethics of what you know to be spiritually right. So it opens a door, much like in demonic possession, you can open a door that allows it to come into you. This is their way. It brings a curse upon you and yourself and your family that through irresponsibility or excessively prideful behavior, which is something that the native cultures abhorred. They did not want you to be prideful or irresponsible or lack empathy for the whole group. You had to, you know, that was vital to their survival. So that became something that was important to them. It's just fascinating. So I'm going to go to another account. This is from a Canadian fur trader and explorer by the name of Alexander Henry. And he was alive from 1765 to 1814. And he wrote an account of what he saw. He said he witnessed what was called a shaking tent ceremony. This was when somebody was taking in and the shaman was attempting to exorcise it. Okay. He said multiple voices, an Englishman, multiple voices were heard coming from the tent, some yelling, some barking like dogs, some howling like wolves, and it was a horrible concert that mingled screams and sobs as of despair and anguish and the sharpest pain. Articulate speech was uttered as if from human lips, but in a tongue not known to any of the audience. Does that not sound a lot like demonic possession? I was really shocked by the correlations between the two, what we consider demonic possession and what they consider Wendigo possession. It overpowered me at different points. I was amazed. There's another story. There's a book by Adam Bigmouth, and it's called Ojibwe Stories from the Upper Barrens River. And this is a story of a conjurer who was one of the witch doctors, if you will, who was seeking out great power. And he was angry because he had asked for the hand of a particular young woman and she was denied him because of his character and because she had already been betrothed to somebody else. So in his anger, he decided to take it out on her family and her. So he cursed her, basically. And he said he'd asked to marry a young woman, but was denied because the father said, no, you know, I already have promised her to someone else. He was insulted, so he set out an effigy of the woman made out of snow. He dipped it in water and put it out to freeze solid. The next day, he buried the effigy in ashes and called upon a Wendigo spirit to inhabit the woman using the effigy as a mystical link, much like the voodoo dolls. He told the father, fine, let her marry the other man, but she will destroy him. And he was right. The woman married, and right after the marriage ceremony, she began to fall ill. She couldn't eat. She became feverish. She complained of having dreams of ice and freezing. This went on for weeks and weeks. And finally, her husband came home from hunting one day, and she sprang upon him and killed him with an axe. Others arrived at the scene and found that she had already eaten half of her husband's back. It was clear she had gone Wendigo And so they had to kill her at that moment, and then they burned her body. Like the effigy that the sorcerer had made of her, the woman's remains were now ash. There was another such story of a black witch, if you will, a blood witch, that was denied a young woman because he asked for her hand and she was young, and because of who his character was. So the father said, no, she's just not old enough. And he cursed the family. And this one I found really gruesome. I apologize, but it is kind of a good story in that it explains how bizarre this can get. So the young girl, a few weeks later, comes home from doing some chores. She finds her mother is still in bed with her infant brother. And she thinks, this is really odd. My mom never sleeps this late. And the baby and her are not moving at all. So she goes over to wake her mom, shake her mom, and mom doesn't move. She flips the blanket back, and because she can see the baby kind of breathing and moving under the blankets. And she found her mother's body to be cold and lifeless. When she pulled the blanket the rest of the way off to see if she could help her baby brother, she found the baby was covered in blood. It had become infested by a Wendigo and had been eating the mother. The Wendigo child had already eaten one breast and was working on the other. She ran to another camp that was close by for help and came back home, and the people came with her. They killed the child, which was a Wendigo, and they noticed that ice had formed along the child's backbone on the outside of its skin. It was believed the spirit had been sent as revenge by the insulted witch. Explorer George Nelson in the early 1800s encountered similar stories while he was traveling among the Ojibwe, which are also Algonquin-speaking people. He talked about a strange, singular, and incomprehensible contradiction in almost all the cases. He said that there were wizards and that they could not be rationally accounted for. When you looked upon them, they didn't make sense, and yet they were true, they were real, things that he saw and experienced along with the native people he was cohabiting with. And I thought, you know, this is just insanely bizarre. So I want to move on to the third step of this thing. Once you've begun eating people and you've tasted human flesh, you begin an irreversible change. You literally become a monster. This is the final stage of the process. They lose their hair. There are some depictions that they have antlers that sprout from their head. Their skin is patchy at best. They grow very tall. I mean, taller than the trees tall. They are thin, gaunt, as though just the skin is pulled over the flesh. You can literally see their ribs and every bone moving. They will roll themselves in pine pitch, cover themselves, and then roll either in sand. If you hear them called stone coats, that's what they're talking about. They'll roll themselves over and over in the sand, creating this crust over themselves, and they look like they're stone moving, stone giants moving. Or they'll roll themselves in pine branches and dirt and whatever debris is in the forest, and then they are camouflaged because they move like the forest, as part of the forest. If they stand still, you're not sure what you're seeing. There are tales of them literally throwing aside boulders, ripping trees out of the ground as they move through the wilderness. Their entire body is encased in ice now. Their features are gaunt, gray, grotesque, not even discernibly human any longer. And they're thin, and they're constantly starved. and they look starved. They have that emaciated, starved look of a being who is dying of starvation. They are gruesome. They have a mouthful of crooked jelly teeth with long fangs, and they cannot be killed by conventional weapons. All that you can do to kill them at this point is to set them on fire. By the way, one of the other traits that will happen is that they will lose their heels. So they walk on the top half of their feet, and the bottom half, the heels, will fall away. So if you can imagine this thing with mincing, prancing thing moving through, their arms grow long down over their knees. They are literally a skeletal mess walking towards you.
No, thank you.
Many of the tribe's children were told not to eat snow out of fear that the Wendigo spirit might use the ice to gain a foothold in them. Even in parts of Minnesota today, it is discouraged to make snowmen for fear that the Wendigo will inhabit the snowman, using the man-like form as a gateway into a physical realm. There is a somewhat similar tradition in the Pennsylvania Dutch where scarecrows, or boeltsmen, are burned before Halloween, or must be burned before Halloween, or risk being inhabited by malevolent spirits. So if it happens to snow before Halloween, if there's scarecrows at the end of the season, they have to be burned before the All Hallows Eve, so that they do not become animated by a spirit very similar to that of a Wendigo. And they show a great affinity for water. In fact, there are some, as I said about the lake one, that say that they come out of the lakes and hide in the water. The water when it's icy cold in the middle of the winter.
That's one disparity, because you've mentioned before that the demons cannot cross water.
Yes, that's one of the very few things that was different. But literally, these things have so many aspects to them. And as I said, you can see correlations with European history, with religious history, and it's just bizarre. I would like to read one last little thing. There was a Canadian anthropologist named Diamond Genet, and he recorded tales of Wendigos. And this is what he said about their sound that they would make when they got in a state. They breathe like it's the whistle of a train, audible for miles, and its shouting weakens the limbs of the person it pursues. They literally, in this stage, will hunt humans to ground and devour them.
All righty. I'm thinking about the next time I'm in the woods, I'm going to have a flamethrower. Whether you can get one or not, I don't know, but yeah, I'll do my best. Yeah.
So I'm going to leave it there. There is a lot more to the Wendigo. If you want to hear more about it, let us know. I found this to be one of the most intense and fascinating research projects I've set out upon. I started out, as I said, thinking sincerely, this is just going to be folklore, and that's fine. Even though I believe that folklore has a grain of truth in it most of the time, not always, but most of the time. I was very early on struck by how very similar this is to demonic possession, to vampirism, to a lot of cultural norms that in Europe and America we're familiar with. We have kind of not really looked at the Wendigo in the past. I don't think many people have as a general rule. It's just a nice little pat yourself on the head, read a spooky book, legend. But if they're right, and if these creatures still walk, and they believe they do, there are other accounts of Wendigos all the way up through. I'll give you one last story. This is a true story. I don't want to name the young man because his family, of course, still is alive. This happened only a few years back. There was a young man who was coming home. I believe he was in the military. He was up in Canada, and he was on a bus, and it was a long journey. So the bus picked him up late in the afternoon. He's on this bus full of other people. They're all traveling to different places, you know, along this bus route. It gets dark in the bus as they're driving through the night. And all of a sudden, there's this guy gets up. He walks up, leans over this particular young soldier. And then literally all hell breaks loose. People start screaming. There's these horrible growls and groans and what have you. And the bus driver's looking frantically for some place to pull over. He can see people getting up out of their seats and pushing toward the back and pushing toward the front. He thinks, oh my God, I'm going to have an accident. And he finally finds a spot, pulls over, flips on the overhead lights, and absolute terror. This man, this Native American man, had torn the head off this young soldier and was eating it while the rest of the bus travelers were trying desperately to get out of that bus.
No kidding.
Yeah. And he had cut his throat, but he had actually torn his head off, was eating it. He was beheaded in that couple seconds. I mean, this literally took less than 60 seconds. So the bus driver kicks open the door. People are pushing open the back door. They get out. They slam the door. They lock this guy in there with the corpse of this poor young man. They call the police. The police come. They finally arrest this guy. And he's taken to jail. Now, in our nice, rational world where we have something called psychology, they said he was a schizophrenic. He had never been diagnosed as a schizophrenic in the past. He had an intense, sudden desire. He said he heard a voice that told him to get up and eat that man. And he followed it. Want to hear something scary? They put him on psych meds, put him in a psych facility for a couple years, and turned him loose. And that happened around 2017.
Canada comes off the tourist list for me, too.
Well, like I said, it happens all over, but that happens to be where that story came from. So everybody, that is my intro to the Wendigo. And there is one last thing I really did want to do before we're out of here. I wanted to make sure that I told you the name of the primary source that I used, because I thought the book was phenomenal. This book is entitled The Wendigo Lore, Monsters, Myths, and Madness by Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson. It is by far one of the best books I've ever read. I really want to give them credit. They were one of my major sources. I read several quotes from the book, and I wanted to let the readers know, if you are fascinated with this subject, Wendigo Lore, Monsters, Myths, and Madness by Chad Lewis and Kevin Lee Nelson is worth every penny.
Alrighty. If I can put a link to that, I will certainly do that.
Yeah. It's on Amazon, so you definitely can put a link to it. It is a phenomenal book. So with that, I am done, and I hope everybody enjoys it. Be careful this winter, as we're getting to that cold season. And good night.